Harper Audio presents The Unbearable Lightness of Being, a novel by Milan Kundera. Translated from the Czech by Michael Henry Heim. Performed by Richmond Hoxie. Part 1. Lightness and Weight. 1. The idea of eternal return is a mysterious one, and Nietzsche has often perplexed other philosophers with it. To think that everything recurs as we once experienced it, and that the recurrence itself recurs ad infinitum. What does this mad myth signify? Putting it negatively, the myth of eternal return states that a life which disappears once and for all, which does not return, is like a shadow, without weight, dead in advance, and whether it was horrible, beautiful, or sublime, its horror, sublimity, and beauty mean nothing. We need take no more note of it than of a war between two African kingdoms in the 14th century, a war that altered nothing in the destiny of the world, even if 100,000 blacks perished in excruciating torment. Will the war between two African kingdoms in the 14th century itself be altered if it recurs again and again in eternal return? It will. It will become a solid mass, permanently protuberant, its inanity irreparable. If the French Revolution were to recur eternally, French historians would be less proud of Robespierre. But because they deal with something that will not return, the bloody years of the Revolution have turned into mere words, theories, and discussions, have become lighter than feathers, frightening no one. There is an infinite difference between a Robespierre who occurs only once in history and a Robespierre who eternally returns, chopping off French heads. Let us therefore agree that the idea of eternal return implies a perspective from which things appear other than as we know them. They appear without the mitigating circumstance of their transitory nature. This mitigating circumstance prevents us from coming to a verdict. For how can we condemn something that is ephemeral, in transit? In the sunset of dissolution, everything is illuminated by the aura of nostalgia, even the guillotine. Not long ago, I caught myself experiencing a most incredible sensation. Leafing through a book on Hitler, I was touched by some of his portraits. They reminded me of my childhood. I grew up during the war. Several members of my family perished in Hitler's concentration camps, but what were their deaths compared with the memories of a lost period in my life, a period that would never return? This reconciliation with Hitler reveals the profound moral perversity of a world that rests essentially on the non-existence of return. For in this world, everything is pardoned in advance, and therefore everything cynically permitted. 2. If every second of our lives recurs an infinite number of times, we are nailed to eternity as Jesus Christ was nailed to the cross. It is a terrifying prospect. In the world of eternal return, the weight of unbearable responsibility lies heavy on every move we make. That is why Nietzsche called the idea of eternal return the heaviest of burdens, das schwerste Gewicht. If eternal return is the heaviest of burdens, then our lives can stand out against it in all their splendid lightness. But is heaviness truly deplorable and lightness splendid? The heaviest of burdens crushes us. We sink beneath it. It pins us to the ground. But in the love poetry of every age, the woman longs to be weighed down by the man's body. The heaviest of burdens is therefore simultaneously an image of life's most intense fulfillment. The heavier the burden, the closer our lives come to the earth, the more real and truthful they become. Conversely, the absolute absence of a burden causes man to be lighter than air, to soar into the heights, take leave of the earth and his earthly being, and become only half real, his movements as free as they are insignificant. What then shall we choose, weight or lightness? Parmenides posed this very question in the 6th century before Christ. He saw the world divided into pairs of opposites, light, darkness, fineness, coarseness, warmth, cold, being, non-being. One half of the opposition he called positive, light, fineness, warmth, being. The other, negative. We might find this division into positive and negative poles childishly simple, except for one difficulty. Which one is positive, weight or lightness? Parmenides responded, "Lightness is positive, weight negative." Was he correct or not? That is the question. The only certainty is the lightness-weight opposition is the most mysterious, most ambiguous of all. 3. I have been thinking about Tomas for many years, but only in the light of these reflections did I see him clearly. I saw him standing at the window of his flat and looking across the courtyard at the opposite walls, not knowing what to do. He had first met Teresa about 3 weeks earlier in a small Czech town. They had spent scarcely an hour together. She had accompanied him to the station and waited with him until he boarded the train. 10 days later, she paid him a visit. They made love the day she arrived. That night, she came down with a fever and stayed a whole week in his flat with the flu. He had come to feel an inexplicable love for this all but complete stranger. She seemed a child to him, a child someone had put in a bulrush basket daubed with pitch and sent downstream for Tomas to fetch at the riverbank of his bed. She stayed with him a week, until she was well again, then went back to her town some 125 miles from Prague. And then came the time I have just spoken of, and see as the key to his life. Standing by the window, he looked out over the courtyard at the walls opposite him and deliberated. Should he call her back to Prague for good? He feared the responsibility. If he invited her to come, then come she would and offer him up her life. Or should he refrain from approaching her? Then she would remain a waitress in a hotel restaurant of a provincial town, and he would never see her again. Did he want her to come, or did he not? He looked out over the courtyard at the opposite walls, seeking an answer. He kept recalling her lying on his bed. She reminded him of no one in his former life. She was neither mistress nor wife. She was a child, whom he had taken from a bulrush basket that had been daubed with pitch and sent to the riverbank of his bed. She fell asleep. He knelt down next to her. Her feverish breath quickened and she gave out a weak moan. He pressed his face to hers and whispered calming words into her sleep. After a while, he felt her breath return to normal and her face rise unconsciously to meet his. He smelled the delicate aroma of her fever and breathed it in, as if trying to glut himself with the intimacy of her body. And all at once he fancied she had been with him for many years and was dying. He had a sudden clear feeling that he would not survive her death. He would lie down beside her and want to die with her. He pressed his face into the pillow beside her head and kept it there for a long time. Now he was standing at the window trying to call that moment to account. What could it have been if not love declaring itself to him? But was it love? The feeling of wanting to die beside her was clearly exaggerated. He had seen her only once before in his life. Was it simply the hysteria of a man who, aware deep down of his inaptitude for love, felt the self-deluding need to simulate it? His unconscious was so cowardly that the best partner it could choose for its little comedy was this miserable provincial waitress with practically no chance at all to enter his life? Looking out over the courtyard at the dirty walls, he realized he had no idea whether it was hysteria or love. And he was distressed that in a situation where a real man would instantly have known how to act, he was vacillating, and therefore depriving the most beautiful moments he had ever experienced, kneeling at her bed and thinking he would not survive her death, of their meaning. He remained annoyed with himself, until he realized that not knowing what he wanted was actually quite natural. We can never know what to want, because living only one life, we can neither compare it with our previous lives, nor perfect it in our lives to come. Was it better to be with Teresa or to remain alone? There is no means of testing which decision is better, because there is no basis for comparison. We live everything as it comes, without warning, like an actor going on cold. And what can life be worth if the first rehearsal for life is life itself? That is why life is always like a sketch. No, sketch is not quite the word, because a sketch is an outline of something, the groundwork for a picture, whereas the sketch that is our life is a sketch for nothing, an outline with no picture. Einmal ist keinmal, says Thomas to himself. What happens but once, says the German adage, might as well not have happened at all. If we have only one life to live, we might as well not have lived at all. 4. But then one day at the hospital, during a break between operations, a nurse called him to the telephone. He heard Teresa's voice coming from the receiver. She had phoned him from the railway station. He was overjoyed. Unfortunately, he had something on that evening and could not invite her to his place until the next day. The moment he hung up, he reproached himself for not telling her to go straight there. He had time enough to cancel his plans, after all. He tried to imagine what Teresa would do in Prague during the 36 long hours before they were to meet, and had half a mind to jump into his car and drive through the streets looking for her. She arrived the next evening, a handbag dangling from her shoulder, looking more elegant than before. She had a thick book under her arm. It was Anna Karenina. She seemed in a good mood, even a little boisterous, and tried to make him think she had just happened to drop in. Things had just worked out that way. She was in Prague on business, perhaps, at this point she became rather vague, to find a job. Later, as they lay naked and spent side by side on the bed, he asked her where she was staying. It was night by then, and he offered to drive her there. Embarrassed, she answered that she still had to find a hotel and had left her suitcase at the station. Only 2 days ago he had feared that if he invited her to Prague, she would offer him up her life. When she told him her suitcase was at the station, he immediately realized that the suitcase contained her life, and that she had left it at the station only until she could offer it up to him. The two of them got into his car, which was parked in front of the house, and drove to the station. There he claimed the suitcase. It was large and enormously heavy, and took it and her home. How had he come to make such a sudden decision when for nearly a fortnight he had wavered so much that he could not even bring himself to send a postcard asking her how she was? He himself was surprised. He had acted against his principles. 10 years earlier, when he had divorced his wife, he celebrated the event the way others celebrate a marriage. He understood he was not born to live side by side with any woman, and could be fully himself only as a bachelor. He tried to design his life in such a way that no woman could move in with a suitcase. That was why his flat had only the one bed. Even though it was wide enough, Thomas would tell his mistresses that he was unable to fall asleep with anyone next to him, and drive them home after midnight. And so it was not the flu that kept him from sleeping with Teresa on her first visit. The first night he had slept in his large armchair, and the rest of that week he drove each night to the hospital, where he had a cot in his office. But this time he fell asleep by her side. When he woke up the next morning, he found Teresa, who was still asleep, holding his hand. Could they have been hand in hand all night? It was hard to believe. And while she breathed the deep breath of sleep and held his hand, firmly he was unable to disengage it from her grip. The enormously heavy suitcase stood by the bed. He refrained from loosening his hand from her grip for fear of waking her, and turned carefully on his side to observe her better. Again it occurred to him that Teresa was a child, put in a pitch-daubed bulrush basket and sent downstream. He couldn't very well let a basket with a child in it float down a stormy river. If the Pharaoh's daughter hadn't snatched the basket carrying little Moses from the waves, there would have been no Old Testament, no civilization as we now know it. How many ancient myths begin with the rescue of an abandoned child? If Polybus hadn't taken in the young Oedipus, Sophocles wouldn't have written his most beautiful tragedy. Tomas did not realize at the time that metaphors are dangerous. Metaphors are not to be trifled with. A single metaphor can give birth to love. 5. He lived a scant 2 years with his wife, and they had a son. At the divorce proceedings, the judge awarded the infant to its mother and ordered Tomas to pay a third of his salary for its support. He also granted him the right to visit the boy every other week. But each time Tomas was supposed to see him, the boy's mother found an excuse to keep him away. He soon realized that bringing them expensive gifts would make things a good deal easier, and that he was expected to bribe the mother for the son's love. He saw a future of quixotic attempts to inculcate his views in the boy, views opposed in every way to the mother's. The very thought of it exhausted him. When one Sunday the boy's mother again canceled a scheduled visit, Tomas decided on the spur of the moment never to see him again. Why should he feel more for that child, to whom he was bound by nothing but a single improvident night, than for any other? He would be scrupulous about paying support. He just didn't want anybody making him fight for his son in the name of paternal sentiments. Needless to say, he found no sympathizers. His own parents condemned him roundly. If Tomas refused to take an interest in his son, then they, Tomas's parents, would no longer take an interest in theirs. They made a great show of maintaining good relations with their daughter-in-law and trumpeted their exemplary stance and sense of justice. Thus, in practically no time, he managed to rid himself of wife, son, mother, and father. The only thing they bequeathed to him was a fear of women. Tomas desired but feared them. Needing to create a compromise between fear and desire, he devised what he called erotic friendship. He would tell his mistresses, "The only relationship that can make both partners happy is one in which sentimentality has no place, and neither partner makes any claim on the life and freedom of the other." To ensure that erotic friendship never grew into the aggression of love, he would meet each of his long-term mistresses only at intervals. He considered this method flawless and propagated it among his friends. "The important thing is to abide by the rule of threes. Either you see a woman 3 times in quick succession and then never again, or you maintain relations over the years but make sure that the rendezvous are at least 3 weeks apart." The rule of threes enabled Tomas to keep intact his liaisons with some women while continuing to engage in short-term affairs with many others. He was not always understood. The woman who understood him best was Sabina. She was a painter. "The reason I like you," she would say to him, "is you're the complete opposite of Kitsch. In the kingdom of Kitsch, you would be a monster." It was Sabina he turned to when he needed to find a job for Teresa in Prague. Following the unwritten rules of erotic friendship, Sabina promised to do everything in her power, and before long she had, in fact, located a place for Teresa in the darkroom of an illustrated weekly. Although her new job did not require any particular qualifications, it raised her status from waitress to member of the press. When Sabina herself introduced Teresa to everyone on the weekly, Tomas knew he had never had a better friend as a mistress than Sabina. 6. The unwritten contract of erotic friendship stipulated that Tomas should exclude all love from his life. The moment he violated that clause of the contract, his other mistresses would assume inferior status and become ripe for insurrection. Accordingly, he rented a room for Teresa and her heavy suitcase. He wanted to be able to watch over her, protect her, enjoy her presence, but felt no need to change his way of life. He did not want word to get out that Teresa was sleeping at his place. Spending the night together was the corpus delicti of love. He never spent the night with the others. It was easy enough if he was at their place. He could leave whenever he pleased. It was worse when they were at his, and he had to explain that come midnight he would have to drive them home, because he was an insomniac and found it impossible to fall asleep in close proximity to another person. Though it was not far from the truth, he never dared tell them the whole truth. After making love, he had an uncontrollable craving to be by himself. Waking in the middle of the night at the side of an alien body was distasteful to him. Rising in the morning with an intruder, repellent. He had no desire to be overheard brushing his teeth in the bathroom, nor was he enticed by the thought of an intimate breakfast. That is why he was so surprised to wake up and find Teresa squeezing his hand tightly. Lying there looking at her, he could not quite understand what had happened. But as he ran through the previous few hours in his mind, he began to sense an aura of hitherto unknown happiness emanating from them. From that time on, they both looked forward to sleeping together. I might even say that the goal of their lovemaking was not so much pleasure as the sleep that followed it. She especially was affected. Whenever she stayed overnight in her rented room, which quickly became only an alibi for Tomas, she was unable to fall asleep. In his arms she would fall asleep, no matter how wrought up she might have been. He would whisper impromptu fairy tales about her, or gibberish, words he repeated monotonously, words soothing or comical, which turned into vague visions lulling her through the first dreams of the night. He had complete control over her sleep. She dozed off at the second he chose. While they slept, she held him as on the first night, keeping a firm grip on wrist, finger, or ankle. If he wanted to move without waking her, he had to resort to artifice. After freeing his finger, wrist, ankle, from her clutches, a process which, since she guarded him carefully even in her sleep, never failed to rouse her partially, he would calm her by slipping an object into her hand, a rolled-up pajama top, a slipper, a book, which she then gripped as tightly as if it were a part of his body. Once, when he had just lulled her to sleep, but she had gone no further than dream's antechamber, and was therefore still responsive to him, he said to her, "Goodbye. I'm going now." "Where?" she asked in her sleep. "Away," he answered sternly. "Then I'm going with you," she said, sitting up in bed. "No, you can't." "I'm going away for good," he said, going out into the hall. She stood up and followed him out, squinting. She was naked beneath her short nightdress. Her face was blank, expressionless, but she moved energetically. He walked through the hall of the flat into the hall of the building, the hall shared by all the occupants, closing the door in her face. She flung it open and continued to follow him, convinced in her sleep that he meant to leave her for good, and she had to stop him. He walked down the stairs to the first landing and waited for her there. She went down after him, took him by the hand, and led him back to bed. Tomas came to this conclusion. Making love with a woman and sleeping with a woman are two separate passions, not merely different, but opposite. Love does not make itself felt in the desire for copulation, a desire that extends to an infinite number of women, but in the desire for shared sleep, a desire limited to one woman. 7. In the middle of the night, she started moaning in her sleep. Tomas woke her up, but when she saw his face, she said, with hatred in her voice, "Get away from me! Get away from me!" Then she told him her dream. The two of them and Sabina had been in a big room together. There was a bed in the middle of the room. It was like a platform in the theater. Tomas ordered her to stand in the corner while he made love to Sabina. The sight of it caused Teresa intolerable suffering. Hoping to alleviate the pain in her heart by pains of the flesh, she jabbed needles under her fingernails. "It hurts so much," she said, squeezing her hands into fists as if they actually were wounded. He pressed her to him, and she gradually, trembling violently for a long time, fell asleep in his arms. Thinking about the dream the next day, he remembered something. He opened a desk drawer and took out a packet of letters Sabina had written to him. He was not long in finding the following passage. "I want to make love to you in my studio. It will be like a stage surrounded by people. The audience won't be allowed up close, but they won't be able to take their eyes off us." The worst of it was that the letter was dated. It was quite recent, written long after Teresa had moved in with Tomas. "So you've been rummaging in my letters." She did not deny it. "Throw me out, then." But he did not throw her out. He could picture her pressed against the wall of Sabina's studio, jabbing needles up under her nails. He took her fingers between his hands and stroked them, brought them to his lips and kissed them, as if they still had drops of blood on them. But from that time on, everything seemed to conspire against him. Not a day went by without her learning something about his secret life. At first he denied it all. Then, when the evidence became too blatant, he argued that his polygamous way of life did not in the least run counter to his love for her. He was inconsistent. First he disavowed his infidelities, then he tried to justify them. Once he was saying goodbye after making a date with a woman on the phone, when from the next room came a strange sound like the chattering of teeth. By chance, she had come home without his realizing it. She was pouring something from a medicine bottle down her throat, and her hand shook so badly the glass bottle clicked against her teeth. He pounced on her as if trying to save her from drowning. The bottle fell to the floor, spotting the carpet with valerian drops. She put up a good fight, and he had to keep her in a straitjacket-like hold for a quarter of an hour before he could calm her. He knew he was in an unjustifiable situation, based as it was on complete inequality. One evening, before she discovered his correspondence with Sabina, they had gone to a bar with some friends to celebrate Teresa's new job. She had been promoted at the Weekly from darkroom technician to staff photographer. Because he had never been much for dancing, one of his younger colleagues took over. They made a splendid couple on the dance floor, and Tomas found her more beautiful than ever. He looked on in amazement at the split-second precision and deference with which Teresa anticipated her partner's will. The dance seemed to him a declaration that her devotion, her ardent desire to satisfy his every whim, was not necessarily bound to his person. That if she hadn't met Tomas, she would have been ready to respond to the call of any other man she might have met instead. He had no difficulty imagining Teresa and his young colleague as lovers. And the ease with which he arrived at this fiction wounded him. he realized that Therese's body was perfectly thinkable, coupled with any male body, and the thought put him in a foul mood. Not until late that night, at home, did he admit to her he was jealous. This absurd jealousy, grounded as it was in mere hypotheses, proved that he considered her fidelity an unconditional postulate of their relationship. How, then, could he begrudge her jealousy of his very real mistresses? 8. During the day she tried, though with only partial success, to believe what Tomas told her, and to be as cheerful as she had been before. But her jealousy, thus tamed by day, burst forth all the more savagely in her dreams, each of which ended in a wail he could silence only by waking her. Her dreams recurred like themes and variations, or television series. For example, she repeatedly dreamed of cats jumping at her face and digging their claws into her skin. We need not look far for an interpretation. In Czech slang, the word cat means a pretty woman. Teresa saw herself threatened by women, all women. All women were potential mistresses for Tomas, and she feared them all. In another cycle, she was being sent to her death. Once, when he woke her as she screamed in terror in the dead of night, she told him about it. I was at a large indoor swimming pool. There were about 20 of us, all women. We were naked and had to march around the pool. There was a basket hanging from the ceiling and a man standing in the basket. The man wore a broad-brimmed hat shading his face, but I could see it was you. You kept giving us orders, shouting at us. We had to sing as we marched, sing and do knee bends. If one of us did a bad knee bend, you would shoot her with a pistol, and she would fall dead into the pool, which made everybody laugh and sing even louder. You never took your eyes off us, and the minute we did something wrong, you would shoot. The pool was full of corpses, floating just below the surface, and I knew I lacked the strength to do the next knee bend, and you were going to shoot me. In a third cycle, she was dead. Lying in a hearse as big as a furniture van, she was surrounded by dead women. There were so many of them that the back door would not close and several legs dangled out. "But I'm not dead," Teresa cried. "I can still feel."
"So can we," the corpses laughed. They laughed the same laugh as the live women who used to tell her cheerfully it was perfectly normal that one day she would have bad teeth, faulty ovaries, and wrinkles, because they all had bad teeth, faulty ovaries, and wrinkles. Laughing the same laugh, they told her that she was dead, and it was perfectly all right. Suddenly she felt a need to urinate. "You see," she cried, "I need to pee. That's proof positive I'm not dead." But they only laughed again. "Needing to pee is perfectly normal," they said. "You'll go on feeling that kind of thing for a long time yet, like a person who has an arm cut off and keeps feeling it's there. We may not have a drop of pee left in us, but we keep needing to pee."
Teresa huddled against Tomas in bed. "And the way they talked to me, like old friends, people who'd known me forever, I was appalled at the thought of having to stay with them forever." 9. All languages that derive from Latin form the word compassion by combining the prefix meaning with, com, and the root meaning suffering, late Latin, passio. In other languages, Czech, Polish, German, and Swedish, for instance, this word is translated by a noun formed of an equivalent prefix combined with the word that means feeling. Czech, soucit. Polish, spolczucie. German, mitgefühl. Swedish, medkänsla. In languages that derive from Latin, compassion means we cannot look on coolly as others suffer, or we sympathize with those who suffer. Another word with approximately the same meaning, pity, French pitié, Italian pietà, etc., connotes a certain condescension towards the sufferer. To take pity on a woman means that we are better off than she, that we stoop to her level, lower ourselves. That is why the word compassion generally inspires suspicion. It designates what is considered an inferior, second-rate sentiment that has little to do with love. To love someone out of compassion means not really to love. In languages that form the word compassion not from the root suffering, but from the root feeling, the word is used in approximately the same way. But to contend that it designates a bad or inferior sentiment is difficult. The secret strength of its etymology floods the word with another light and gives it a broader meaning. To have compassion, co-feeling, means not only to be able to live with the other's misfortune, but also to feel with him any emotion, joy, anxiety, happiness, pain. This kind of compassion, in the sense of susit, spoltuce, mitgefühl, mitgefühl, therefore signifies the maximal capacity of affective imagination, the art of emotional telepathy. In the hierarchy of sentiments, then, it is supreme. By revealing to Tomas her dream about jabbing needles under her fingernails, Teresa unwittingly revealed that she had gone through his desk. If Teresa had been any other woman, Tomas would never have spoken to her again. Aware of that, Teresa said to him, "Throw me out." But instead of throwing her out, he seized her hand and kissed the tips of her fingers, because at that moment he himself felt the pain under her fingernails as surely as if the nerves of her fingers led straight to his own brain. Anyone who has failed to benefit from the devil's gift of compassion, co-feeling, will condemn Teresa coldly for her deed, because privacy is sacred, and drawers containing intimate correspondence are not to be opened. But because compassion was Tomas's fate or curse, he felt that he himself had knelt before the open desk drawer, unable to tear his eyes from Sabina's letter. He understood Teresa, and not only was he incapable of being angry with her, he loved her all the more. 10. Her gestures grew abrupt and unsteady. 2 years had elapsed since she discovered he was unfaithful, and things had grown worse. There was no way out. Was he genuinely incapable of abandoning his erotic friendships? He was. It would have torn him apart. He lacked the strength to control his taste for other women. Besides, he failed to see the need. No one knew better than he how little his exploits threatened Teresa. Why then give them up? He saw no more reason for that than to deny himself soccer matches. But was it still a matter of pleasure? Even as he set out to visit another woman, he found her distasteful and promised himself he would never see her again. He constantly had Teresa's image before his eyes, and the only way he could erase it was by quickly getting drunk. Ever since meeting Teresa, he had been unable to make love to another woman without alcohol. But alcohol on his breath was a sure sign to Teresa of infidelity. He was caught in a trap. Even on his way to see them, he found them distasteful. But one day without them, and he was back on the phone, eager to make contact. He still felt most comfortable with Sabina. He knew she was discreet and would not divulge their rendezvous. Her studio greeted him like a memento of his past, his idyllic bachelor past. Perhaps he himself did not realize how much he had changed. He was now afraid to come home late because Teresa would be waiting up for him. Then one day, Sabina caught him glancing at his watch during intercourse and trying to hasten its conclusion. Afterwards, still naked and lazily walking across the studio, she stopped before an easel with a half-finished painting and watched him sidelong as he threw on his clothes. When he was fully dressed, except for one bare foot, he looked around the room. and then got down on all fours to continue the search under a table. "You seem to be turning into the theme of all my paintings," she said. "The meeting of two worlds, a double exposure, showing through the outline of Tomas the Libertine, incredibly the face of a romantic lover, or the other way, through a Tristan, always thinking of his Teresa. I see the beautiful, betrayed world of the Libertine." Tomas straightened up and, distractedly, listened to Sabina's words. "What are you looking for?" she asked.
"A sock."
She searched all over the room with him, and again he got down on all fours to look under the table. "Your sock isn't anywhere to be seen," said Sabina. "You must have come without it."
"How could I have come without it?" cried Tomas, looking at his watch. "I wasn't wearing only one sock when I came, was I?"
"It's not out of the question. You've been very absent-minded lately, always rushing somewhere, looking at your watch. It wouldn't surprise me in the least if you forgot to put on a sock." He was just about to put his shoe on his bare foot. "It's cold out," Sabina said. "I'll lend you one of my stockings." She handed him a long, white, fashionable, wide-net stocking. He knew very well she was getting back at him for glancing at his watch while making love to her. She had hidden his sock somewhere. It was indeed cold out, and he had no choice but to take her up on the offer. He went home wearing a sock on one foot and a wide-net stocking rolled down over his ankle on the other. He was in a bind. In his mistress's eyes, he bore the stigma of his love for Teresa. In Teresa's eyes, the stigma of his exploits with the mistresses. 11. To assuage Teresa's sufferings, he married her. They could finally give up the room, which she had not lived in for quite some time, and gave her a puppy. It was born to a St. Bernard owned by a colleague. The sire was a neighbor's German shepherd. No one wanted the little mongrels, and his colleague was loath to kill them. Looking over the puppies, Tomas knew that the ones he rejected would have to die. He felt like the President of the Republic standing before four prisoners condemned to death and empowered to pardon only one of them. At last, he made his choice. A bitch whose body seemed reminiscent of the German Shepherd and whose head belonged to its St. Bernard mother. He took it home to Teresa, who picked it up and pressed it to her breast. The puppy immediately peed on her blouse. Then they tried to come up with a name for it. Tomas wanted the name to be a clear indication that the dog was Teresa's, and he thought of the book she was clutching under her arm when she arrived unannounced in Prague. He suggested they call the puppy Tolstoy. "It can't be Tolstoy," Teresa said. "It's a girl. How about Anna Karenina?"
"It can't be Anna Karenina," said Tomas. "No woman could possibly have so funny a face. It's much more like Karenin, yes, Anna's husband. That's just how I've always pictured him."
"But won't calling her Karenin affect her sexuality?"
"It's entirely possible," said Tomas, "that a female dog addressed continually by a male name will develop lesbian tendencies."
Strangely enough, Tomas's words came true. Though bitches are usually more affectionate to their masters than their mistresses, Karenin proved an exception, deciding that he was in love with Teresa. Tomas was grateful to him for it. He would stroke the puppy's head and say, "Well done, Karenin. That's just what I wanted you for. Since I can't cope with her by myself, you must help me." But even with Karenin's help, Tomas failed to make her happy. He became aware of his failure some years later, on approximately the 10th day after his country was occupied by Russian tanks. It was August 1968, and Tomas was receiving daily phone calls from a hospital in Zurich. The director there, a physician who had struck up a friendship with Tomas at an international conference, was worried about him and kept offering him a job. 12. If Tomas rejected the Swiss doctor's offer without a second thought, it was for Teresa's sake. He assumed she would not want to leave. She had spent the whole first week of the occupation in a kind of trance almost resembling happiness. After roaming the streets with her camera, she would hand the rolls of film to foreign journalists, who actually fought over them. Once, when she went too far and took a close-up of an officer pointing a revolver at a group of people, she was arrested and kept overnight at Russian military headquarters. There, they threatened to shoot her. But no sooner did they let her go than she was back in the streets with her camera. That is why Tomas was surprised when on the 10th day of the occupation she said to him, "Why is it you don't want to go to Switzerland?"
"Why should I?"
"They could make it hard for you here."
"They can make it hard for anybody," replied Tomas with a wave of the hand. "What about you? Could you live abroad?"
"Why not?"
"You've been out there risking your life for this country. How can you be so nonchalant about leaving it?"
"Now that Dubček is back, things have changed," said Teresa. It was true. The general euphoria lasted no longer than the first week. The representatives of the country had been hauled away like criminals by the Russian army. No one knew where they were. Everyone feared for the men's lives, and hatred for the Russians drugged people like alcohol. It was a drunken carnival of hate. Czech towns were decorated with thousands of hand-painted posters bearing ironic texts, epigrams, poems, and cartoons of Brezhnev and his soldiers, jeered at by one and all as a circus of illiterates. But no carnival can go on forever. In the meantime, the Russians had forced the Czech representatives to sign a compromise agreement in Moscow. When Dubček returned with them to Prague, he gave a speech over the radio. He was so devastated after his 6-day detention he could hardly talk. He kept stuttering and gasping for breath, making long pauses between sentences, pauses lasting nearly 30 seconds. The compromise saved the country from the worst. The executions and mass deportations to Siberia that had terrified everyone. But one thing was clear. The country would have to bow to the conqueror. Forever and ever it will stutter, stammer, gasp for air like Alexander Dubček. The carnival was over. Workaday humiliation had begun. Teresa had explained all this to Tomas, and he knew that it was true. But he also knew that underneath it all hid still another, more fundamental truth. The reason why she wanted to leave Prague. She had never really been happy before. The day she walked through the streets of Prague taking pictures of Russian soldiers and looking danger in the face were the best of her life. They were the only time when the television series of her dreams had been interrupted, and she had enjoyed a few happy nights. The Russians had brought equilibrium to her in their tanks, and now that the carnival was over, she feared her nights again and wanted to escape them. She now knew there were conditions under which she could feel strong and fulfilled, and she longed to go off into the world and seek those conditions somewhere else. "It doesn't bother you that Sabina has also emigrated to Switzerland?" Tomas asked. "Geneva isn't Zurich," said Teresa. "She'll be much less of a difficulty there than she was in Prague." A person who longs to leave the place where he lives is an unhappy person. That is why Tomas accepted Teresa's wish to emigrate as the culprit accepts his sentence. And one day he and Teresa and Karenin found themselves in the largest city in Switzerland. 13. He bought a bed for their empty flat. They had no money yet for other furniture. And threw himself into his work with the frenzy of a man of 40 beginning a new life. He made several telephone calls to Geneva. A show of Sabina's work had opened there by chance a week after the Russian invasion. And in a wave of sympathy for her tiny country, Geneva's patrons of the arts bought up all her paintings. "Thanks to the Russians, I'm a rich woman," she said, laughing into the telephone. She invited Tomas to come and see her new studio, and assured him it did not differ greatly from the one he had known in Prague. He would have been only too glad to visit her, but was unable to find an excuse to explain his absence to Teresa. And so Sabina came to Zurich. She stayed at a hotel. Tomas went to see her after work. He phoned first from the reception desk, then went upstairs. When she opened the door, she stood before him on her beautiful long legs, wearing nothing but panties and bra, and a black bowler hat. She stood there staring, mute and motionless. Tomas did the same. Suddenly he realized how touched he was. He removed the bowler from her head and placed it on the bedside table. Then they made love without saying a word. Leaving the hotel for his flat, which by now had acquired table, chairs, couch, and carpet, he thought happily that he carried his way of living with him as a snail carries his house. Teresa and Sabina represented the two poles of his life, separate and irreconcilable, yet equally appealing. But the fact that he carried his life support system with him everywhere like a part of his body meant that Teresa went on having her dreams. They had been in Zurich for 6 or 7 months when he came home late one evening to find a letter on the table telling him she had left for Prague. She had left because she lacked the strength to live abroad. She knew she was supposed to bolster him up, but did not know how to go about it. She had been silly enough to think that going abroad would change her. She thought that after what she had been through during the invasion, she would stop being petty and grow up, grow wise and strong, but she had overestimated herself. She was weighing him down and would do so no longer. She had drawn the necessary conclusions before it was too late, and she apologized for taking Karenin with her. He took some sleeping pills, but still did not close his eyes until morning. Luckily, it was Saturday, and he could stay at home. For the 150th time, he went over the situation. The borders between his country and the rest of the world were no longer open. No telegrams or telephone calls could bring her back. The authorities would never let her travel abroad. Her departure was staggeringly definitive. 14. The realization that he was utterly powerless was like the blow of a sledgehammer. Yet it was curiously calming as well. No one was forcing him into a decision. He felt no need to stare at the walls of the houses across the courtyard and ponder whether to live with her or not. Teresa had made the decision herself. He went to a restaurant for lunch. He was depressed, but as he ate, his original desperation waned, lost its strength, and soon all that was left was melancholy. Looking back on the years he had spent with her, he came to feel that their story could have had no better ending. If someone had invented the story, this is how he would have had to end it. One day Teresa came to him uninvited. One day she left the same way. She came with a heavy suitcase. She left with a heavy suitcase. He paid the bill, left the restaurant, and started walking through the streets, his melancholy growing more and more beautiful. He had spent 7 years of life with Teresa, and now he realized that those years were more attractive in retrospect than they were when he was living them. His love for Teresa was beautiful, but it was also tiring. He had constantly had to hide things from her, sham, dissemble, make amends, buck her up, calm her down, give her evidence of his feelings, play the defendant to her jealousy, her suffering, and her dreams, feel guilty, make excuses and apologies. Now what was tiring had disappeared, and only the beauty remained. Saturday found him for the first time strolling along through Zurich, breathing in the heady smell of his freedom. New adventures hid around each corner. The future was again a secret. He was on his way back to the bachelor life, the life he had once felt destined for, the life that would let him be what he actually was. For 7 years he had lived bound to her, his every step subject to her scrutiny. She might as well have chained iron balls to his ankles. Suddenly his step was much lighter. He soared. He had entered Parmenides' magic field. He was enjoying the sweet lightness of being. Did he feel like phoning Sabina in Geneva? Contacting one or another of the women he had met during his several months in Zurich? No, not in the least. Perhaps he sensed that any woman would make his memory of Teresa unbearably painful. 15. This curious, melancholic fascination lasted until Sunday evening. On Monday, everything changed. Teresa forced her way into his thoughts. He imagined her sitting there writing her farewell letter. He felt her hands trembling. He saw her lugging her heavy suitcase in one hand and leading Karenin on his leash with the other. He pictured her unlocking their Prague flat and suffered the utter abandonment breathing her in the face as she opened the door. During those 2 beautiful days of melancholy, his compassion, that curse of emotional telepathy, had taken a holiday. It had slept the sound Sunday sleep of a miner who, after a hard week's work, needs to gather strength for his Monday shift. Instead of the patients he was treating, Tomas saw Teresa. He tried to remind himself, "Don't think about her. Don't think about her." He said to himself, "I'm sick with compassion. It's good that she's gone and that I'll never see her again. Though it's not Teresa I need to be free of, it's that sickness, compassion, which I thought I was immune to until she infected me with it." On Saturday and Sunday, he felt the sweet lightness of being rise up to him out of the depths of the future. On Monday, he was hit by a weight the likes of which he had never known. The tons of steel of the Russian tanks were nothing compared with it. For there is nothing heavier than compassion. Not even one's own pain weighs so heavy as the pain one feels with someone, for someone, a pain intensified by the imagination and prolonged by 100 echoes. He kept warning himself not to give in to compassion, and compassion listened with bowed head and a seemingly guilty conscience. Compassion knew it was being presumptuous, yet it quietly stood its ground. And on the 5th day after her departure, Tomas informed the director of his hospital, the man who had phoned him daily in Prague after the Russian invasion, that he had to return at once. He was ashamed. He knew that the move would appear irresponsible, inexcusable to the man. He thought to unbosom himself and tell him the story of Teresa and the letter she had left on the table for him. But in the end he did not. From the Swiss doctor's point of view, Teresa's move could only appear hysterical and abhorrent. And Tomas refused to allow anyone an opportunity to think ill of her. The director of the hospital was, in fact, offended. Tomas shrugged his shoulders and said, "Es muss sein, es muss sein." It was an illusion. The last movement of Beethoven's last quartet is based on the following 2 motifs.
Muss es sein,
must it be?
Es muss sein,
it must be.
Es muss sein,
it must be. To make the meaning of the words absolutely clear, Beethoven introduced the movement with a phrase, "Der schurgefaschte Anschluss," which is commonly translated as "the difficult resolution." This allusion to Beethoven was actually Tomas's first step back to Teresa, because she was the one who had induced him to buy records of the Beethoven quartets and sonatas. The allusion was even more pertinent than he had thought, because the Swiss doctor was a great music lover. Smiling serenely, he asked, in the melody of Beethoven's motif,
"Muss es sein? Ja, Es muss sein,
Tomas said again. 16. Unlike Parmenides, Beethoven apparently viewed weight as something positive. Since the German word schwer means both difficult and heavy, Beethoven's difficult resolution may also be construed as a heavy or weighty resolution. The weighty resolution is at one with the voice of fate, es muss sein. Necessity, weight, and value are three concepts inextricably bound. Only necessity is heavy, and only what is heavy has value. This is a conviction born of Beethoven's music, and although we cannot ignore the possibility, or even probability, that it owes its origins more to Beethoven's commentators than to Beethoven himself, we all more or less share it. We believe that the greatness of man stems from the fact that he bears his fate as Atlas bore the heavens on his shoulders. Beethoven's hero is a lifter of metaphysical weights. Tomas approached the Swiss border. I imagine a gloomy, shock-headed Beethoven in person conducting the local fireman's brass band in a farewell to emigration, an Es muss sein march. Then Tomas crossed the Czech border and was welcomed by columns of Russian tanks. He had to stop his car and wait a half hour before they passed. A terrifying soldier in the black uniform of the armored forces stood at the crossroads directing traffic, as if every road in the country belonged to him and him alone. Es muss sein, Tomas repeated to himself. But then he began to doubt. Did it really have to be? Yes, it was unbearable for him to stay in Zurich, imagining Teresa living on her own in Prague. But how long would he have been tortured by compassion? All his life? A year? Or a month? Or only a week? How could he have known? How could he have gauged it? Any schoolboy can do experiments in the physics laboratory to test various scientific hypotheses. But man, because he has only one life to live, cannot conduct experiments to test whether to follow his passion, compassion, or not. It was with these thoughts in mind that he opened the door to his flat. Karenin made the homecoming easier by jumping up on him and licking his face. The desire to fall into Teresa's arms, he could still feel it while getting into his car in Zurich, had completely disintegrated. He fancied himself standing opposite her in the midst of a snowy plain, the two of them shivering from the cold. 17. From the very beginning of the occupation, Russian military airplanes had flown over Prague all night long. Tomas, no longer accustomed to the noise, was unable to fall asleep. Twisting and turning beside the slumbering Teresa, he recalled something she had told him a long time before in the course of an insignificant conversation. They had been talking about his friend, Z, when she announced, "If I hadn't met you, I'd certainly have fallen in love with him." Even then, her words had left Tomas in a strange state of melancholy. And now he realized it was only a matter of chance that Teresa loved him and not his friend Z. Apart from her consummated love for Tomas, there were, in the realm of possibility, an infinite number of unconsummated loves for other men. We all reject out of hand the idea that the love of our life may be something light or weightless. We presume our love is what must be, that without it our life would no longer be the same. We feel that Beethoven himself, gloomy and awe-inspiring, is playing the Es muss sein to our own great love. Tomas often thought of Therese's remark about his friend Z, and came to the conclusion that the love story of his life exemplified not Es muss sein, it must be so, but rather Es könnte auch anders sein, it could just as well be otherwise. 7 years earlier, a complex neurological case happened to have been discovered at the hospital in Therese's town. They called in the chief surgeon of Tomas's hospital in Prague for consultation. But the chief surgeon of Tomas's hospital happened to be suffering from sciatica, and because he could not move, he sent Tomas to the provincial hospital in his place. The town had several hotels, but Tomas happened to be given a room in the one where Teresa was employed. He happened to have had enough free time before his train left to stop at the hotel restaurant. Teresa happened to be on duty and happened to be serving Tomas's table. It had taken 6 chance happenings to push Tomas towards Teresa, as if he had little inclination to go to her on his own. He had gone back to Prague because of her. So fateful a decision, resting on so fortuitous a love that would not even have existed had it not been for the chief surgeon's sciatica 7 years earlier. And that woman, that personification of absolute fortuity, now again lay asleep beside him, breathing deeply. It was late at night. His stomach started acting up, as it tended to do in times of psychic stress. Once or twice her breathing turned into mild snores. Tomas felt no compassion. All he felt was the pressure in his stomach and the despair of having returned. Part 2. Soul and Body. 1. It would be senseless for the author to try to convince the reader that his characters once actually lived. They were not born of a mother's womb. They were born of a stimulating phrase or two from a basic situation. Tomas was born of the saying, "Einmal ist keinmal." Teresa was born of the rumbling of a stomach. The first time she went to Tomas's flat, her insides began to rumble. And no wonder. She had had nothing to eat since breakfast but a quick sandwich on the platform before boarding the train. She had concentrated on the daring journey ahead of her and had forgotten about food. But when we ignore the body, we are more easily victimized by it. She felt terrible standing there in front of Tomas, listening to her belly speak out. She felt like crying. Fortunately, after the first 10 seconds, Tomas put his arms around her and made her forget her ventral voices. 2. Teresa was therefore born of a situation which brutally reveals the irreconcilable duality of body and soul, that fundamental human experience. A long time ago, man would listen in amazement to the sound of regular beats in his chest, never suspecting what they were. He was unable to identify himself with so alien and unfamiliar an object as the body. The body was a cage, and inside that cage was something which looked, listened, feared, thought, and marveled. That something, that remainder left over after the body had been accounted for, was the soul. Today, of course, the body is no longer unfamiliar. We know that the beating in our chest is the heart, and that the nose is the nozzle of a hose sticking out of the body to take oxygen to the lungs. The face is nothing but an instrument panel, registering all the body mechanisms, digestion, sight, hearing, respiration, thought. Ever since man has learned to give each part of the body a name, the body has given him less trouble. He has also learned that the soul is nothing more than the gray matter of the brain in action. The old duality of body and soul has become shrouded in scientific terminology, and we can laugh at it as merely an obsolete prejudice. But just make someone who has fallen in love listen to his stomach rumble, and the unity of body and soul, that lyrical illusion of the age of science, instantly fades away. 3. Teresa tried to see herself through her body. That is why, from girlhood on, she would stand before the mirror so often. And because she was afraid her mother would catch her at it, every peek into the mirror had a tinge of secret vice. It was not vanity that drew her to the mirror. It was amazement at seeing her own eye. She forgot she was looking at the instrument panel of her body mechanisms. She thought she saw her soul shining through the features of her face. She forgot that the nose was merely the nozzle of a hose that took oxygen to the lungs. She saw it as the true expression of her nature. Staring at herself for long stretches of time, she was occasionally upset at the sight of her mother's features in her face. She would stare all the more doggedly at her image in an attempt to wish them away and keep only what was hers alone. Each time she succeeded was a time of intoxication. Her soul would rise to the surface of her body like a crew charging up from the bowels of a ship, spreading out over the deck, waving at the sky and singing in jubilation. 4. She took after her mother, and not only physically. I sometimes have the feeling that her entire life was merely a continuation of her mother's, much as the course of a ball on the billiard table is merely the continuation of the player's arm movement. Where and when did it begin, the movement that later turned into Teresa's life? Perhaps at the time when Teresa's grandfather, a Prague businessman, began extolling the beauty of his daughter, Teresa's mother, for all to hear. When she was 3 or 4, he would tell her that she was the image of Raphael's Madonna. Teresa's 4-year-old mother never forgot it. When, as an adolescent, she sat at her desk in school, she would not listen to the teachers. She would think about which paintings she was like. Then came the time for her to marry. She had 9 suitors. They all knelt round her in a circle. Standing in the middle, like a princess, she did not know which one to choose. One was the handsomest, another the wittiest. The third was the richest, the fourth the most athletic, the fifth from the best family. The 6th recited verse. The 7th traveled widely. The 8th played the violin. And the 9th was the most manly. But they all knelt in the same way. They all had the same calluses on their knees. The reason she finally chose the 9th was not so much that he was the most manly of all, as that when she whispered, "Be careful, very careful," to him during their lovemaking, he was purposely careless, and she had to marry him after failing to find a doctor willing to perform an abortion. And so Teresa was born. Numerous relatives gathered from all corners of the country to lean over the pram and talk baby talk. Teresa's mother talked no baby talk. She did not talk at all. She thought about the 8 other suitors, all of whom seemed better than the 9th. Like her daughter, Teresa's mother frequently looked in the mirror. One day she discovered wrinkles near her eyes and decided her marriage made no sense. At about that time, she met an unmanly man who had several charges of fraud on his record, not to mention 2 failed marriages. Now she hated those suitors with their calloused knees. She had a passionate desire to be the one to kneel for a change. She went down on her knees before her new swindler friend and left her husband and Teresa to fend for themselves. The most manly of men became the most downcast. He became so downcast that nothing meant anything to him anymore. He said openly what was on his mind, and the communist police, shocked by his rash statements, arrested him, brought him to trial, and sentenced him to a long term in prison. They closed up his flat and sent Teresa to stay with her mother. The most downcast of men died after a short spell behind bars, and Teresa and her mother went to live in a small town near the mountains with her mother's swindler. The swindler worked in an office, her mother in a shop. Her mother also gave birth to 3 more children. Then she looked in the mirror again and discovered she was old and ugly.